You're listening to the Illustration Hour podcast, an interview podcast where I talk to illustrators, art directors, and agents about the craft and business of illustration. My name is Julia Dufossé, and I'm an editorial and commercial illustrator based in Chicago. And I'm chatting with creatives within the world of illustration to learn about their process, the challenges they faced along the way, and how to succeed as an illustrator today. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Illustration Hour, the show about people who create for a living. I'm your host, Julia Dufossé, an illustrator, and this week I'm very happy to bring you a new interview with the illustrator and artist Armando Veve. But before I introduce Armando, did you know you can get exclusive and essential news for illustrators and designers delivered to your inbox every week? Go to illustrationhour.com/newsletter to find out more and join the club. And you can always hit reply and talk to me directly if you have questions or comments or suggestions. I always answer these messages before I do anything else. So you get priority access plus all the best things I've found to help you thrive as an illustrator just for being a subscriber. Every Monday, you'll get a letter from me designed for you as a creative professional. So go on and join the club at illustrationhour.com/newsletter. Okay, on to the show. Let me introduce you to Armando Veve. You can find Armando on his website at armandoveve.com or on Instagram where he is at Armando Veve. Go follow him. You won't be sorry. Armando is an illustrator known for his masterful use of graphite and surreal compositions. Armando's work is remarkable in his extreme attention to detail and the care he puts into his medium. Armando's illustrations are truly magical with a very tactile feel. His concepts are equally impressive. And we talk a lot about how Armando comes up with ideas and concepts. Armando has a propensity for the surreal, and humor plays a huge role in his work. 2018 was a very big year for Armando as he received the ADC Young Gun Award from the One Club for Creativity and was named in Forbes 30 Under 30 list. Since then, Armando's work has expanded into even more realms, including commercial work with companies like Absolute and Urban Outfitters. As you'll learn in this conversation, Armando got his start in editorial illustration after graduating from RISD. We talk about his post-graduation plans and how he gradually discovered how he wanted to work and what type of work he wanted to produce. From there, Armando accumulated commissions from clients like the New York Times, the MIT Tech Review, The New Yorker, Wired, Mother Jones, and many, many more. Armando has received many awards over the years, including quite a few distinctions from the Society of Illustrators and many others. And despite what you might think, I found Armando to be an extremely humble person, and I really admired his drive for self-improvement and the way he is continually pushing to expand and evolve professionally. So in this conversation, we chat about Armando's start, how he developed his style and voice, how he figured out his place as an illustrator. And we talk a lot about process and tools. We talk about Armando's love for graphite, why he still uses traditional graphite over digital programs and brushes, and how he actually makes his mind-bending illustrations. I could go on and on about Armando and how much I appreciated my time with him. So without further ado, here is my conversation with the illustrator Armando Veve. Armando, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm really good. Thanks for being on the show. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. Chat illustration.
So 2018 was a really good year for you. You earned 2 gold medals from the Society of Illustrators, and you were named an ADC Young Gun, and you also got on the Forbes 30 under 30 list.
Yeah, it was a busy year. I feel like that it was kind of a turning point in my career. I started to grow out of just editorial work and kind of expand into other projects. The work was getting more recognition. I felt like I was more a part of the conversation than before. So yeah, it was definitely, it was an exciting year for sure.
Was it surprising for you to get all those awards like in the same year? Were you expecting it at all? Or?
No, I don't think anyone's ever expecting it. Yeah, it was very surprising. I mean, I was working also a lot.
I imagine it feels kind of surreal when you get all those awards in the same year.
Yeah, and I try not to think too much about the awards. It's amazing to get them, to receive the recognition, but at the end of the day, doing the work is most important, and finding a way to enjoy the work is what I try to focus on. But I am grateful that we have these institutions that support the work, that give us a community, that give us a sense of a history of works that have been made. A lot of these annuals become historical artifacts of the time period, and awards allow us to kind of see what stood out in any given year. So it's definitely amazing to be part of this long lineage, and yeah, it's cool.
Yeah. So I want to go back to more to the beginning, to how you got started. I know that you attended RISD. When did you graduate? It was in
I graduated 2011. So it's now been a while. Yes, I studied illustration there. Yeah, so I studied illustration at RISD. I studied with Chris Bazzelli, who taught an editorial illustration course that really gave me the tools to approach my first art directors after school. Even though I was at RISD, I was kind of a mess. I didn't really know what I wanted from my work. I was actually taking classes in the painting department and illustration as well, and kind of between worlds, or especially at RISD, departments are very segregated, and you kind of feel this kind of distinction between the fine art and commercial worlds, which I don't think is a true representation of the world we live in. But because of that, I felt a kind of identity crisis, not really knowing where my work existed. But after school, I kind of looked back on my education at RISD, and I think it was Chris's class that kind of stood out to me in terms of valuable skills to implement my work in the world. So I started with the editorial illustration, and then everything kind of grew from there. It took me a few years before I actually got published.
Yeah, before you got your first commission?
Yeah, I think it was about 2 or 3 years. And it was partly because I wasn't putting my work out there. I had this fear of, not of commercializing, of creating something that would be out of my control, that would be governed by other people's opinions. And I really just wanted to make art for myself. But it was quickly apparent that you can't really support yourself by just being so insular. You have to find a way to there goes the train. There's a train that goes by my studio window every 20 minutes or so. But I wanted to find a way to connect my work and to the world around me, and I felt editorial was a great way to do that. And really, that was the only way of putting my work out there that I knew of. I wasn't getting any gallery work. I was making my drawings. I wasn't selling them, but the editorial illustration seemed to be a very simple path to receiving a commission, getting paid for it, and seeing your work published. So I tried to figure out a way to do that.
Yeah. And so at RISD, was that where you developed, I guess, the kind of the technical side of your work? Because you have a very... You have a very particular style. You use graphite and you work in quite a traditional way. So it was that where you kind of learned to do that, or did that start before?
I think if anything, RISD kind of gave me the conceptual foundation to the work that I do. I've been drawing since I was very young. And I've always, even as a teenager, I was making copies of master drawings and copying National Geographic photographs. I was drawing in graphite from a young age, but I kind of stopped at RISD. At RISD, I was painting more. I was really experimenting and, again, not really knowing what way of working was really something I enjoyed. I just kind of tried everything, and building on my conceptual thinking. But it wasn't until after school that I kind of went back to my pre-RISD days, when I was really enjoying the drawing, and I started drawing in pen and ink, and then graphite. And it was the graphite that kind of merged with the speed of my thinking. It allowed me to work texturally, and it just felt right. It also allowed me to edit in a way the pen and ink didn't. I was able to work faster. So I've been working in graphite for a bit now with some... I've been adding other media, but it's been... I really love the graphite right now.
Yeah. So it started, I guess, with a more, you were trying to copy reality much more. Sounds like RISD gave you more like different kinds of ideas to put into your drawing, not just copying reality. And
Right. RISD kind of broke everything apart and kind of made me rethink everything. It really kind of exposed they pulled the skin off of my work, and I was able to see the muscles and the bones and the organ systems. I was able to really figure out what it was that I wanted to say. I didn't leave RISD with a full, with an exact idea of what I wanted to do. But I think after years of reflecting, I realized I really did start a lot of the conceptual thinking in my RISD projects that I still use today in my editorial work.
Did you have a portfolio that was kind of was it there after you graduated, or did it take you like those 2 or 3 years of actually making work and thinking about it?
No, I mean, when I left RISD, my portfolio was all over the place. It was just every piece looked like it was created by a different artist. I just really didn't know what I wanted to do. But after RISD, I think the last piece I created at RISD was a pen and ink drawing, and was the start of a series that I continued during the summer after graduation. And then that led to 3 or 4 other pen drawings. And those 5 works were the pieces that I shared with an art director at the New York Times. So at that point, I had not received any commissioned work. I thought I was going to be exhibiting in galleries. And that was kind of the trajectory I was trying to go down. I applied to grants and residencies, but it got rejected to all of them. eventually I did do a residency, but it was not until I had kind of started the illustration work. So yeah, it was a very strange period of time, but I think over time I kind of, it was also a very important period of time, because I was able to grow outside of the expectations of a client. And I feel like I was able to really dig deep and think about what did I enjoy about the process? What kind of work did I want to make? What did I want to see out in the world? And the work then kind of just naturally flowed from that kind of thinking.
Yeah. Do you remember your first commission? I guess the first commission you got?
Yes, very clearly. It was it was a piece for the New York Times op-ed. The art director was Aviva Mikhailov, so I give her credit for believing my work before.
Yeah.
She's really intelligent and really knows how to bring out the best concepts in the work. So she gave me, I had reached out, she was actually the art director I reached out to with the five works, and I think I received a positive response, which I was so excited about, but then I didn't hear back from her for about 8 or 9 months. And it was in the middle of, I think I was working part-time, and it was that day, while I was working, I received the email, and I called out sick, said yes to the assignment. And I had about 2 days to complete the assignment, and it was an absolute, I was an anxious mess, because at the time I was working in pen and ink, and the work that she had referenced was a stippled pen and ink drawing that I knew took about 2 weeks to complete. And I had 2 days to complete this piece, and I didn't know any other way of really approaching the assignment. And I was very stubborn in terms of wanting it to look a certain way. And so I was struggling to finish the work on time. But what happened is, at the very last minute, she got in touch saying that the piece had been pushed back to the following week. So I had another week to work on the drawing. And I don't know what would have happened if I didn't have that extra week. Because with that extra time, I was able to produce the best possible piece I could have under that timeline. So I am forever grateful to her for trusting me. And then more work kind of came from there. So that's kind of how it started.
Do you remember what the piece was about? Like what the concept was that you were illustrating?
Yeah, it was a heart test for babies. It was like a scan. Oh, there's the train. it was a scan. Heart scan for babies it was a long time ago. It was a heart test to see if the baby was more susceptible to heart conditions.
Okay.
So I did but they wanted a kind of optimistic look at the piece, a piece that showed a kind of hope, because this new procedure would save the lives of many babies. And so I did I took the heart and kind of showed a cross-section of the heart as a kind of playground. And the baby is sitting inside of this strange heart-shaped playground. So that was the first one.
And did it end up being in graphite or in a pen? Because you mentioned...
No, that was all stippled pen and ink. Mm-hmm. It was a really laborious process. I used to use rapidograph pens. And just stipple. And I love, love, love the look of it. I feel like nothing can replicate it fully. And the crispness of the blacks and the density of the texture of the stippling, there's something super beautiful about it that I will always love. But in terms of the timeline, I don't think in terms of communicating an idea, whether working in graphite or pen and ink, if it really makes that much difference. I think you can still achieve a similar effect with the graphite, and it saves you so much more time. And when I switched to graphite, I was able to work with more complex ideas and scenes, and be a little bit more relaxed in the creation of the work. So I think that's, yeah, so it was pen and ink, but it was the last time.
Yeah. And rapidographs are just famously unforgiving. Like, it, you can really mess up really fast, even when you're just not careful.
Yeah, I mean, I still to this day can't have a rapidograph not clog. And then I try to clean the rapidograph, and I still haven't found a way to do this. And I always end up breaking that little needle inside of the tip, and then it, you have to buy another tip. So, and then I tried Microns, but Microns, I just feel like the blacks aren't, in terms of looking at the original drawing, you don't get that feeling of the India ink that comes from a rapidograph pen.
Yeah, and the precision is just, it's not as precise, I feel, yeah.
Right, and I used to also change the color of the ink in the rapidograph, so I would put in, I have a bunch of colored inks, and I would just create custom colored inks, and so I would start drawing in magentas and blues and greens as a way to kind of move away from the black and white. And that work inspired some later colored pencil pieces that were monochromatic. And it's interesting because that work, which was made maybe in 2013, was referenced for a recent piece for the New York Times that was all monochromatic cyan. So it's interesting how sometimes it's this cycle of... recently, art directors have been referencing a lot of the earlier works, and I find myself kind of thinking again back to those pieces, trying to get back into the mindset of what I was thinking and seeing if I can build on that thinking.
So, and then, so after that, after this first commission of and using the rapidograph, did you move to graphite after that, like immediately, or?
Oh, yeah. It was so stressful. I don't like that feeling of not having, like,
not knowing if you're going to be able to do it. Yeah.
To finish. Yeah. That's a very stressful mindset. And I feel like when the parameters are already so tight, I think it's important to find a process that allows you to flow and be more relaxed so you can be as creative as you can be because the timelines are crazy sometimes, but I mean, that's the reality of the job, is that you have to learn how to work under these really tight circumstances.
So explain to me, like, the appeal of graphite for you. Why do you love using it so much?
Well, graphite for me, well, one, it's like writing. It has the same feeling as if you're writing a story. We use the same tools to write as we do to draw. There's something very humble about it. It's such a simple media that can do so much. And going back to the writing part, is I often think of illustration as writing. It's writing, but with pictures. And so when I try to think that way when I'm working, thinking about the ideas and the stories I'm trying to tell. But going back to graphite, there's a softness, there's a range of textures that graphite can create. It can be super soft and ghostly, but then it can also be super tight and graphic. And I think having that range allows for more kinds of ideas to happen. And it's also easy to edit in a way. Sometimes certain areas get too dark, but that's why I use sandpaper. But everyone can relate to a pencil. People know when it's a pencil drawing, and people know what it's like to hold a pencil. And I think that kind of level of connection gives people a reason to look a little bit longer.
Yeah. What are the cons of using graphite the way that you do?
There is no control Z in a way. Sometimes it's funny that now that I use the computer a lot in the development stages of drawings. And a lot of times when I'm working on paper, I find myself kind of making a mistake, and then automatically my brain says control Z, as if I can go back in time. So creating edits can take a bit longer. It's not impossible to make edits. With some Photoshop retouching, you can usually hide anything that's too glaring. But I think it takes a little bit longer, but I think it's worth it in the end. What else?
Do you worry about smearing and all that kind of stuff, or?
I used to, but I've developed a few techniques. Well, one, simply just covering the area that you're not drawing on, just to avoid any smudging that way. Sometimes I'll use other tools to support my palm, so I'm not resting my palm on the paper. There's a few techniques you can use to avoid smudging. Unfortunately, I'm right-handed, so there's less of a chance to smudge as opposed to working left-handed. But yeah, you kind of have to be creative with everything in terms of making it work, creating workarounds.
Yeah, and why not use? I guess today we see a lot of people using, you know, virtual pencils in Procreate or in Photoshop. Why is that not something that you would consider?
So I actually have recently been trying to find the perfect digital pencil, and I've been using my sketching as an opportunity to experiment with digital pencils, because I don't want to reach a point in my career where I just have no idea how to use digital tools. So when it comes to other aspects of the process, I try to implement other techniques. But so recently I've been using some Kyle T. Webster brushes, digital pencils, and also I forgot the other packages, but I've downloaded a few others, and I have not been able to find a digital pencil that can replicate the look and feel of a pencil, especially when you zoom in. And I'm relieved about that. I was afraid that I was a little bit worried that that the effort I put into the pencil drawings might become obsolete at some point. But I don't I don't know. I think it really is a timeless media, and the digital pencils are amazing. I think for sketching, I used to do my sketching for projects on tracing paper, and now I work directly in the computer because when I have to make an edit, I don't have to make another sketch. I can just quickly rearrange things. I can squash and stretch and kind of really actively work the sketch until it feels right, and then I can make a last tracing of that sketch. But and so for that I use some of the digital pencils, I don't know if I'll ever, at least for now, use a digital pencil in a final piece, because it just doesn't have the same softness and there's a texturing in the pencil that just you can't replicate.
Mm-hmm. That's tough. I know what you mean. It's just the pencils, the digital pencils never feel like the real thing. And maybe it's because the texture just repeats over and over again. I don't know. It doesn't do it like that.
I've been trying to figure out why. But there's one pencil I've found, I don't have the name of it right now, I can give it to you after, that I think is the most realistic looking pencil, and it's pressure sensitive, and it has a kind of randomness to it that feels like a pencil. Some of them just get to be a little bit too sketchy, or I could go on and on.
There's an over-exaggeration of the roughness sometimes I see.
Sometimes it's too soft and it's blurry. It doesn't have the crispness. Sometimes there was one project I did where I used a digital pencil to make a very quick edit. And when it published, I noticed that area was much more, was much sharper in a really distracting way. I don't doubt that there will be, as the technology becomes more sophisticated, that there will be tools that look more realistic. But I think right now, the pencil, using a real pencil is still the best way to go.
Is there part of you also that likes to, I guess, to feel the pencil and to work on real paper and not on a screen?
Yes, definitely. I think my brain thinks differently on paper. I work well when I have limitations. And I think working on paper makes it so that I can't make it too... I feel like on the computer, there are too many options available. It's too easy to keep changing and to try out many different directions for a drawing. And in the end, it can drive you crazy because you can't really... It's hard to think clearly about what would be the best direction. But when you're working on paper, there's a kind of direct connection with the subject, and you kind of just have to go with whatever is happening in that moment and just trust it. It's easier to trust the marks, I think, for me when I'm working directly on the paper as opposed to in the computer, because I know it's coming from myself and it's not translated through this digital machine, if that makes any sense. Also, just practically, you have all these original drawings that you can sell. So I have, and then you can exhibit them as well. So right now I have drawers and drawers of originals, and it's great to have these objects. The one thing I can't get over with working completely digitally is that you don't really have the work around. You have these digital files, and you can make beautiful prints, but the prints are prints. It's nothing like seeing the original.
Yeah, there's an extra step separating you from the work that you just don't have when you create it like you do.
Yeah, it's a mystery, this whole process. And I don't know if I'll ever... There will never be a right or a wrong way to work, but I think it's... If I'm following my gut and my heart, I choose the paper.
Are you very particular with the kind of paper you use and the kind of tools you use? Because I imagine you have your favorite pencils, you have your favorite paper, your favorite fixative, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've tried many, many papers, and I've landed on a Stonehenge drawing paper. I used to do colored pencil stuff. And it seems to, that's where I learned about it, and it works. It accepts the colored pencil really well. It has a slight texture, which works well for the graphite. And I also like the tone of the paper. It's not too cream and it's not too white. So it adds enough warmth, but it's not, too overpowering. So that paper, and I think it's traditionally a printmaking paper. So there's a sizing on it that I think is what allows for the pencil to kind of glide on it a little bit more than other papers. And then I used to use just student grade pencils for a long time, but it was weird. After using pencils for several years, I finally, for the first time in my life, understood the difference between student grade and professional grade pencils. And although they're more expensive, I realize it's really worth it. And the professional pencils break less, I think, because the student grade pencils are not as pure. They tend to fracture and break the actual graphite inside. But the new, the professional grade are mixed with a clay that makes them a little bit more flexible. They also produce darker darks and lighter lights. And I know when I'm holding a 2B as opposed to an H, the 2B is going to be a certain level of darkness. So it's, and I think they're Faber-Castells. I think that's how you say it. The green ones. Those work really well for me. And sometimes I'll add colored pencil to the pieces, depending on the piece.
And do you use a particular kind of color pencil as well, or
I love Prismacolors.
Yeah,
just the they're I don't know the just the professional grade Prismacolors are good. I love like the nude and like cream colors. Sometimes I'll add just a little bit of those to the graphite, and it creates a nice undulating kind of texture, or it makes some of the graphite appear a little bit warmer than other areas, which keeps your eye moving around. But yeah.
Do you use the whole range of like softness and hardness, or do you have like pencils that you use way more than others?
I definitely use a whole range. I used to only use one or two of them, but now I finally understand the benefit of using a full range. Sometimes if you're using a pencil that's too hard at first, you might press too hard, and what happens is you end up embossing the paper. Oh. And it's hard to make edits or work on top. Or if you lay a darker color on top, usually you see the white embossing, which I've actually used that effect for scaling on like a dragon, or creating different kind of embossed effects. Sometimes work for tree bark, but it's best to kind of start with a softer pencil and work your way to a harder pencil as you're burnishing the piece in the last steps. But everyone works differently. I know someone, I spoke to an illustrator who only uses like 6HHH because they love the softness, and it works for their subject matter, and their pieces have this glowing quality that's really difficult to achieve, and it almost like a silver point drawing. But for me, I'm definitely aware of creating a full value range in the pieces. And so I think it's, I sometimes go up to 8B and go to 4H, depending maybe on the cat's whiskers will be 6H, but then the grapes behind will be 8B. It depends on what I'm doing. But at this point, I kind of don't really think too much. It's very natural. I can, I just pick up the, I know what hardness now will create a certain effect. And so I kind of, it's more of a natural flow.
That's really interesting. I'm really interested in that. I don't know a lot about the medium. But what you said about the professional grade pencils having clay makes so much sense to me. I imagine that the less experienced you are, the more likely you are not to use the full range, because you can't really comprehend exactly why you would use certain pencils in certain cases. For me, when you said like the cat's whiskers are 6H, it's like you might as well be saying something in a foreign language.
Right. I mean, and it really is. It is its own language. But we're all accustomed to the HB, which is the classic number two pencil. And when you use an HB, you can create an image with a full value range. But when you see the nuances of a 6H and you compare it to the HB, you all of a sudden your expressive range becomes much wider, and you realize, oh, my cat whiskers can actually be more spindly. Maybe I can communicate this idea in a more exaggerated way. Maybe the fur can be hairier, and I'm not, or I keep doing cats and a fur, but maybe the metallic surface can be softer if I use a 6H as opposed to trying to complete it in an 8B. Maybe a rusted metallic surface should be more of a softer pencil, so that it catches more of the, because with the harder pencil can go into the divots of the paper, whereas the softer pencil kind of shows the white, the valleys of the paper become the white speckling. So you create different effects depending on how you use the pencil. But I think what's great about the pencil is that it works differently based on whatever hands are using it. Yeah. So I think even though it is a simple tool, it has an infinite number of expressive possibilities.
Yeah. You're talking really about knowledge that becomes second nature as much as you become more experienced. But I also think you have, you pay attention to details in a way that really distinguishes you
too much.
Yeah, but it's a good thing, because I think it's allowed you to really become a master of that medium too.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the day, I'm definitely a nerd when it comes to the technical side of illustration. I'm always trying to, that's what excites me, is that every day is an opportunity to maybe get better at the craft. There's still a lot of areas that I know I can evolve on. There's a lot of areas that I can grow in.
I guess where I was going also with the question was, like, I was wondering why for some people don't really pay attention to those little details, and why it is that you have, that you really pay attention to the little details, the little the subtle differences between, I guess, a 6H and another pencil or stuff like that, but the paper.
Because I'm a tortured artist. I have a goal this year to lighten up a little bit.
No, I don't think you should. It's
my pain is other people's pleasure. But it's weird. I try to, when I'm working on a piece, I'm thinking both of the big picture and also the work on a microscopic scale. I try to make sure that each piece kind of has an impact from a distance, but also can deliver more on a second read. So for those, because you have your audience has a diversity of attention spans. There are some people who may just blink and look at the piece and walk away, but there are others who will collect the work, who will look more deeply at the piece. And I think a lot of the times I'm making my work for those people who are willing to sit a little bit longer, slow down, and think about all the elements in a piece. But when it comes to the detail, I think it's just in my nature to kind of keep pushing even when maybe it was time to let go.
Yeah. I'd love to know exactly, like, how do you usually start work and how do you progress as the piece gets more refined? Maybe if you could take an editorial commission as an example. I don't know if you have a favorite one or one that you would, that you remember well.
Let's see. Maybe I can talk about, I probably can't talk about one I'm doing right now, but.
Oh, yeah.
So a recent piece, or I'll just first talk about, like, the general, it's a similar process each time. Usually the art director reaches out and they, with a story or a brief prompt. And I love reading the manuscript. A lot of illustrators try to think that if they read the manuscript, they might get too much information. But I like to get a sense of control over the subject matter. And I try to become a master of whatever it is that I'm reading. So right now I'm doing a piece about a parasite, and so I'm learning a lot about these parasites in our pores. Usually I start with reading the manuscript, and what I sometimes do is, if it's a long feature story, or if there's a lot of information, I'll usually type out maybe a page of phrases or ideas that come to mind, and I limit myself to one page, because if I start typing out more than a page, then it means that I'm not focusing the idea or really figuring out what this piece is about. Because I think in the end, I should be able to come out with one sentence that I use as my kind of thesis or my guiding force for a piece. So I usually do that. So I have that one page typed out sheet that I then tape on my drafting table. And then at that point, I just start developing sketches. And I use index cards now. I used to draw in a sketchbook, but now the index cards are really helpful because I can tape them on the wall and then I can rearrange them. And usually I can see different possibilities, or maybe there's an idea, a better idea, if I hybridize or if I fuse different ideas. Or maybe if I chop one and chop another and put them, kind of Frankenstein them together, a better thing, maybe a sky of one and a cityscape of another, coming together will work better. So I have these index cards and I usually scan them in. I picked like three of them.
Are they very detailed at this stage or not at all?
No, they're very, I used to do super detailed sketches. I think mostly because I wanted to impress the art director. I thought that I needed to impress them along the way, but really I've learned that it's a very organic process and it's actually better to present the sketches just should still be clear. They shouldn't just be, especially if you're doing a more detailed work, they shouldn't just be, stick figures, but you can be very loose with them. And sometimes I'll add a sentence or two below the thumbnail so that they are able to, because ultimately the art director is going to show your sketch to an editor and the editor needs to be able to envision how the piece will exist in the publication. So as long as it's clear enough for a an untrained eye to understand the idea, then it's fine. But also it's important to be loose because you want to quickly get a sketch approved so you have more time to work on the final drawing. And if you're spending all that time creating perfect sketches, you might eat into some valuable time to finish your piece. So over time, I'm no longer embarrassed by by rough sketches. So yeah, on those index cards, I just use a black ink pen and really just scribble the first things that come to my mind. And those, I then try to find a way to clean them up a bit. Maybe I'll scan them into the computer and then use some of those digital pencils I mentioned.
You'll retrace them or something? Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, at that point, they're really indecipherable. They look like a chicken just made a few scribbles on a paper, but I know what those scribbles mean. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I use those as a kind of code to, because a lot of times these ideas at a certain point kind of come so quickly in your mind and they just, it's hard to capture all of them. And that's the other thing is that I sometimes for a project, I'll come up with 10 ideas, but I try to only show three. I think when you show too many, it becomes a problem for the art directors.
Yeah.
Because you want to be confident in your process. And at the end of the day, really just think about what do you want to draw at that moment? Because they're always going to pick the worst one. It's always the one that usually if I write abstract composition or something where it's very, it's always the one that's less fleshed out. But I think it has resulted in some unexpected and surprising compositions for me. Mm-hmm.
Do you worry about composition at this stage, or do you worry mostly about the concepts?
I think I start with concept first, then composition, and then based on the amount of time I have, I kind of gauge what level of detail I might approach. Some drawings work better with a lot of detail. I've learned the hard way that some pieces are actually better if you take a more simple approach. Some newspaper drawings I've done that were really detailed, they looked like a smudge on when they were printed, and you couldn't even see all of the little characters I incorporated in it. Just seeing that made me realize that there's a time and place for detail. Mm-hmm. Magazines are, especially with glossy pages with great print quality, are an amazing place for detail because people also usually spend more time with a magazine than a newspaper. So
yeah,
I think you just have to kind of, or large posters, you kind of have to think about the context for the drawing.
Mm-hmm. So what happens after, I guess, after you have your sketch approved? What do you usually do?
So the sketch has been approved. Then run around the block a few times. Then I kind of, it's a, so right now there's a train going by. It seems like it's a very long train. I don't know if you can hear it.
It's okay. Yeah.
But anyway, so if you hear the rumbling, that's what it is. But so at this point, it's kind of mental preparation and organizing to start the marathon. And I do see it like an endurance sport. I try to, when I'm working on these assignments, I make sure I'm sleeping well, I'm exercising, I'm eating well, because it takes a lot out of you to create these works of art under such tight circumstances. So I usually continue to clean up the sketch. I overthink the sketch and try to see, is it
in Photoshop?
Well, I'm usually just staring at it. Okay. I'm just staring at it and wondering if it could be better. Now, the more that I do, I try to eliminate this step, but it's what usually happens is that I then go back to the original sketch and I say, this is fine. And then I move forward and I bring it into the computer and I just try to clean it up further, getting the big elements in. If there's, and I'm also at the same time collecting reference photos, which is a really important step for me. Mm. And I think that's what allows me to get detailed, is that I, even if it's a specific shoe, or if it's a specific hairstyle or tree or leaf, I usually have several folders per project, so that I can reference them. I've tried recently, I used to be very, very tied to my reference photos. And recently, I don't know if this is because of experience, but I find that I can rely less on these photos and work more from memory. And it often leads to more interesting results. And it seems to be some of the drawings have become a little bit looser in that way, where a leaf doesn't have to be look so much like a leaf. It can be what is the representation or symbol of a leaf, and how can that exist in an image that maybe has other objects that are more relying on reference.
So when do you actually start, bring out the piece of paper that you're going to do your final drawing? Is there a stage where you decide this is, I'm starting the actual piece?
Yeah, it's always,
now.
It's like these first stages, I feel like, are like a dress rehearsal. I'm trying to eliminate the dress rehearsal as much as possible these days, because I just want to find a more pure approach to making the work and trying to edit less. But usually, yes, I do a lot of this pre-planning. And when I feel like I can't pre-plan anymore because I'm running out of time, I then start the drawing. And so the starting the drawing just usually requires me to transfer the sketch. And then from there, I have all of my reference photos, and it's almost like I'm a printer. I just kind of start with one object, but I'm moving all over the composition at the same time. So it's just a organic process from there. I usually have to create lists. I'm a list person. And mm-hmm. because some of these pieces are so dense with so many elements, I usually have to just write a list of three things at a time. Otherwise, it's way too overwhelming. So I might say, the sky, left shoe, cargo ship. So those three. So then all I have to do for the next 2 hours or 1 hour is just focus on those three things. And I don't have to think about whether I have enough time to finish a piece, whether I'm ready. It's just, I think focusing the mind and organizing and compartmentalizing thoughts is really important for these more complex pieces. And sometimes I'll even cover the whole drawing, except for the part that I'm working on, because that way it's just a much more streamlined way of thinking. I don't have to think about everything at the same time, which can become exhausting. I just have to focus on the smaller elements. But then at the end, it's really important to see the whole piece at once, so you don't get too caught up in each little element that in the end won't really change, make or break the overall idea.
So I'm picturing you doing this, and at the same time, I'm trying to picture myself doing anything remotely resembling what you do. And I'm picturing, I guess, making the first marks on paper, hating it, and then tossing it. Does that ever happen to you in some way? Or
Yeah. I mean, it's usually the first hour is filled with absolute dread and doubt. It's just, it's kind of...
Yeah.
But I mean, that's part of the game. It's the mind is built that way to make you feel small in a way. And I think it's, you just really have to implement.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of work to really reverse these thought patterns and really enjoy the process and just be open to the fear and the risk of, yes, this might be the most terrible thing you ever make, but there's something exciting about that.
Yeah.
So I used to have crippling mm-hmm. doubt and anxiety when I was younger, especially because it was tied to, I was making works for national publications that I knew a lot of people would be seeing the works. And I think I put too much pressure on myself. Because at the end of the day, these are drawings. Drawings are not meant to carry this much weight. And I think it's great when drawings are able to carry some depth, but I don't think it's necessary for the artist to have that much suffering and depth in order to create works that are powerful and impactful.
Yeah. Do you like the stage of coming up with ideas? Is that something you enjoy?
Oh, it's my favorite part. I feel like the process is just a process of dying after that. It's my brain is on fire at that stage. I can feel, it's because all of there's so many possibilities where the project can go. And it's at this stage, it's really dictating, the look and feel and research. It's really everything is possible. And there's a looseness and lack of self-judgment at this stage too, where I'm really allowing mm-hmm. just everything to flow. And it's usually in the next stages where that critical person inside kind of starts saying, hey, that composition looks weird, or hey, that, and it's, I'm trying to quiet those voices. And then the piece ends in a drawer or in a public, no, I shouldn't think like that. The piece, it's a process of getting crisper, or it's a process of editing that I think can kill that initial vibrancy. And constant cycle of how loose should I go? Because, for example, at the start of this conversation, you mentioned that you appreciated the attention to detail and the density of the layering and stuff. But that kind of layering happens through an intensive process of editing and time spent on a piece. And so it's this constant mm-hmm, cycle of mm-hmm. there, even though that process it creates is, it's a bit of friction for me. It's kind of like working uphill. It does lead to a more rewarding ski down the mountain.
It does create a sort of visual delight for the person who's looking at the piece. But do you ever think about, I guess I always worry about this in my work, like the balance between simplifying and abstracting, and on the other hand, I guess still having complexity in what you're representing, still having visual interests. That's something I always kind of struggle with, because I tend to be more on the simple side, and I guess I see you as more on the other side, maybe.
I think that's the constant struggle that most artists face, is, and especially with a media like illustration that is all about communication, you kind of have to, you think a lot about how do I communicate this idea in a way that is most effective? When is it okay to over describe something? When is it better to simplify uh-huh. something? And I think that's the constant struggle that will never go away. And that's the knowing when to let go is something that an artist has to learn. I still struggle with that. It's knowing how far do mm-hmm. I push this flower? How far do I push this scene? I know I can add 30 more objects in this composition, but is it necessary to add 30 more? Does it add to the intensity, or is that intensity detracting from the story I'm trying to tell? I think it's a constant back and forth.
Mm-hmm. How do you see your role like as an editorial illustrator? Is it to really accompany the story, or is it to explain it?
I like to think of the illustration as something that augments the story. So when I'm working on an illustration for an editorial piece, I do try to reflect content I see in the story, but I'm also trying to read between the lines and see if there's something else there that I can highlight that might add to the read. I think it's often interesting when you have work drawings accompany stories that really don't have a lot to do with the story, but might offer a different perspective. And I think there's an idea in the space between the illustration and the text, if that makes sense.
Yeah. It's almost like it can have, it's very interesting when the illustration and the text are a little bit further apart, but there is a limit to that distance, I guess. And it still has to, somebody from who comes into the article and has not read it needs to understand how it relates, I guess, in mm-hmm. some way.
Yeah, and I do have to say, I also find it refreshing, though, to kind of work on the opposite side of the spectrum and create work that is overly descriptive. Sometimes the stories that you read are just so weird that creating a exact representation of what is described in the story can actually lead to a stranger result. Sometimes you need the illustration to mm-hmm. really intensify the experience of something that's so visceral in the piece. Sometimes mm-hmm. we want to imagine, sometimes it's hard to imagine something, and we want, especially when it comes to fantasy and science fiction, sometimes it's great to have the illustration just to give us a guide in our mind. But yeah, that can be subjective too.
Yeah. You illustrate a lot of scientific concepts, I think, in your work. Or I guess, the medicine, health, the body. But do you worry about, I guess, visually representing scientific concepts? I think it can very easily fall prey to cliches in a way that other topics maybe not as much. I don't know
if
that makes sense.
Can you elaborate on that? I'm curious in that idea.
I think because, I mean, I don't know. I think of the DNA. Yeah. I think I don't know. I think of the microbes and parasites, all that kind of stuff. We have images in mind for that are very cliche, and I can just, I think about this in my work, but it's very hard to, it's very hard to think of something that's not cliche sometimes for those things. I think economy also is something where we have a lot of visual ideas of how things look.
I agree. I think that's the core, that's one of the core aspects of this career, is knowing how to take something that is so banal and everyday and kind of make it a bit more extraordinary or make us think differently about it. And with scientific content, I agree. You get a lot of the same themes. And I think for me, the way that I try to think about, or the way I try to come up with a new idea, is maybe bridging it with a completely disparate field. Like, for example, if I am doing a piece on let's say I'm doing a piece on the creative, let's say I'm doing a piece on, oh my God, I can't think of that. okay. So I'll just, any piece, with a scientific content, maybe bridging it with something like furniture design or bridging mm-hmm. it with landscape painting. How can you convey the scientific content, in a different realm of thinking? Maybe there's an intersection between the content and music, and maybe that will inspire a kind of thinking for a new drawing. Or maybe I think it's about pulling out the unexpected, and that can just simply be done by taking two pre-existing things and merging them together to see if something new comes out of it. Sometimes, though, I think when you're aware of the cliche elements, you can play with it. I think there was a piece that I did for a business magazine, and I remember consciously incorporating businessmen and symbols of money and all of that mm-hmm. because it became kind of absurd.
Yeah.
There's something kind of, I don't know how to describe the feeling, but it was stranger to be so direct with it. Yeah, literal. There's something funny about being literal, if that makes sense. In some cases, it works. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I always think of the fear I always have is having an illustration that's just like, you know, that chart with a business, with a dollar sign next to it or something.
Yeah, I mean, be very conscious of the kinds of images you put out in the world, because those are the kinds of images you will be hired yeah. for. So, for example, I started doing cross sections of heads, and now all of a sudden everyone wants a cross section of a head.
Oh, I bet, yeah.
but I mean, that the thing, though, is that I love cross sections. I love scientific content. So I love, I don't mind that I'm being asked to draw more cross sections. I could do this for a long time, I feel like, because there's so many possibilities of how it can open up and how many of what you can reveal on the inside. And it's something I enjoy. So I don't mind that. But if you're drawing businessmen, or if you're doing a lot of political imagery, you're probably going to get political work. Yeah. So it's just a matter of put out what you want to do.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. I'm wondering, I know we're running out of time quickly, and I could keep talking to you more about the conceptual kind of side of illustration. But I'm wondering if you ever still experiment with different mediums.
Yeah, so that is something I'm thinking about. I've been experimenting recently with watercolor, mm-hmm. Trying to see if there's a way that I can integrate the watercolor with the graphite to create new effects. I've been working with the colored pencil and also pen and ink mm-hmm. again. I have this dream to do a comic.
Oh.
And it's something very out of my comfort
zone.
That
would be so amazing in your style, I think.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out a way to see if I can make that work, because I mean, I might have to simplify something, but yeah, so it's just a very different mode of thinking. And I feel like it would be really fun and refreshing to do something so different. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just a one page or a two page comic to start with, just something. So that's a goal of mine this year.
Well, that's great.
But otherwise, I'm pretty busy with the commercial, mm-hmm. with the commissioned work. So I don't have a lot of time to experiment, but I'm happy with where I'm at right now with the process. It works for me, and there's still enough room to experiment and to push myself conceptually. And so I think, since I think so much more about the ideas as opposed to the execution, I feel like my process is kind of infinite mm-hmm. in a way, because there are so many different ideas, and every idea kind of introduces me to a new way of drawing the subject.
So it just dawned on me that you, you don't always color your work, but when you do you tend to do it also with analog kind of media, or do you do it on Photoshop usually?
It's a combination. I think because of editorial, I had to find a quicker way to work for the color, and I knew that it'd be easier if I worked digitally so that it was flexible. So I right now, I usually scan in, I do some rough watercolor on watercolor paper, kind of in the general shapes of certain areas, and I'll scan those in. Sometimes I have boxes of pastels and other markers and stuff. I'll create other textures and try to bring them in.
So you're creating a kind of collage in Photoshop and pasting them. Yeah, I see. Okay.
Yeah, collage, I feel like, is at the root of all of my work. From the conceptual stages, I'm kind of Frankensteining all these things together, to the drawing is a kind of collage, bringing together these elements, infusing them through the drawing, and then collaging the layers of the Photoshop are collage. So yeah, collage is definitely at the core of a lot of this.
That's really cool. I have one more question before I ask you some more like fun, rapid questions. But the last question is, I guess a lot of people always ask this of people who've experienced success in the field, and I think you have. But if you could give young illustrators or artists starting out today advice, what would you say to them?
I think the first thing would be to don't wait for the perfect moment to share your work. The work is always in a constant state of development. And I think that the fact that we are kind of constantly growing is what makes this career so interesting. So don't wait to share your work. Put it out there. Be open to criticism. Be open to making mistakes. Also, stop worrying. I feel like as I enter the third decade of my life, I would tell my 20-year-old self that it's not worth worrying so much. And in the end, creativity dies with worrying.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Do you think of yourself as an anxious person? Or
definitely. Yeah. I mean, I think it's just in my blood. But I exercise a lot, which helps. I try to get my mind outside of the illustration. But yeah, I think I'm naturally prone to worrying.
Yeah.
It runs in my family.
I think I have that too. Yeah.
But, but fortunately, I have stable friends who support me. But I'm working on it.
Yeah. I'm the kind of worrier, I think, who isolates themselves more than... Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I need to be with myself when I'm worried. But that's like a different.
It's difficult, and sometimes it gets to be a lot. But sometimes it's a matter of knowing when to step away, knowing other healthy routines to kind of break that cycle, because it is a habit, and it's a matter of just kind of rewiring the brain to. Deal with that anxiety and those feelings and abstract them so that you recognize them, but you don't have to feel fear. You can kind of throw them away and move on and be excited about those feelings.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I've been going to therapy.
Well, yeah.
So
I have too, and most people should.
I think it's really important if you're an artist to kind of consider therapy. It's really helped me in terms of kind of navigating some of these very complex thoughts. I spend a lot of time alone too, so it's nice to be able to just kind of decompress, talk about projects, talk about life, talk about things that are on my mind. So it's a healthy part of the whole, and maybe essential part of the creative studio practice.
Yeah, I would agree. So I have some quicker question. The first one that I have is, and I guess I'm suspecting it's a question you get a lot, but what do you recommend when people ask you your advice for getting started with drawing? Because I feel like people probably ask you that.
Well, I think the key is to just start. I think there's no, again, there's no perfect moment to begin. There's no perfect tool to use. I think it's just a matter of getting a piece of paper or drawing surface and just starting and being open to the mistakes. There's so many references. As a younger artist, I copied a lot of work I admired. Mm-hmm. I think at that stage, of the, it would be weird if I did that. Maybe it would be, I at least I can't show any of that stuff if I'm doing it. But but as a young artist, copy the work that you see. Try to kind of dissect what went behind the creation of that work. Try to use the same tools. There's a lot of books, and now online, there's so many communities of artists coming together to share work, to share advice. Mm-hmm. So definitely reach out to these communities. Reach out to the artists that you admire. Definitely feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions about mm-hmm. The career. We're all here to help each other. And I think at a certain point, you kind of, I don't think art school is necessary for the education of an artist, but I think it does, for me, it introduced me to a network of like-minded people who I consider some of my closest friends. It introduced me to a certain level of professionalism that you can probably learn through other jobs, but it was, I think I learned it faster. But in the end, it's really a matter of knowing how to get your work in front of the right people. And there's many, and that sometimes is just simply sending an email of your work to a commissioning art director, which is how I started.
Yeah. And are there any books on drawing that you recommend to people or that you would recommend?
I have a lot of looking, I have like books.
You have it sounds like you have reference more than, you know, straight up practical.
Yeah, I have like a lot of anatomy books that I reference, but there was a book I read recently that I've been recommending to some people. It's called How to Read Nancy by Paul Karasik and Mark Newgarden. And what they do is they take one panel of Ernie Bushmiller's Nancy comic and they scrutinize and analyze every single element in this one comic. And it's kind of a absurd look at abstraction, and communication. So I've been, ever since looking at that book, I've been thinking a lot more about the power of saying less. And I always have a tendency to be very maximal with my work. And it's all of a sudden I've been looking at pictures in a slightly different way, looking at, wow, you can draw a straight line and that can act as an entire horizon. Mm-hmm. And just wondering, I mean, as we spoke, this kind of constant struggle of knowing when to let go, how much do you need to describe something? That book I really enjoyed. And then, yeah, I think, oh, I also read, this is funny, this is another how-to. This is a How to Do Nothing by Jenny O'Dell.
Yeah, I've heard of that. I've never read it, but.
That was really good. So I actually deleted my Facebook account because after reading that book. And it talks about resisting a capitalist world that feeds on our data. And the way to do that is to disengage and be more fully present with your world.
That's really hard to do. It is.
It's so hard. I mean, social media, I mean, that's a complex issue because it is a powerful business tool. It gives us the ability to connect with other people, creatives all over the world. I to be honest, I can't imagine my career without social
Instagram.
Media.
Yeah.
Yes. It's incredible that we have this at our disposal. But at the same time, it is detrimental to our attention span. And I think when it comes to creating works of art, you need a certain level of focus and a certain level of attention to really dive deep into what you're doing. I just don't understand how some people can be fully present on social media and also fully present in their work. Maybe they have someone else managing the social media, but it's just, it's a lot.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have to have it. It's essential for a career.
Yeah, it's a useful tool.
Illustration right now, unless you're working on book projects and you're out for a year at a time, but it's really powerful. So if you know how to use it, it can be really help push your career forward.
What books do you find yourself returning to often, I guess, to either draw inspiration from or comfort?
You know, I still carry around all of my childhood, like children's books that I used to read as a child.
Really?
And there's something, sometimes when I'm kind of doubting, when the process gets too difficult and I'm kind of doubting why I even started, why I'm still doing illustration, which is sometimes it's, I think that's natural to kind of question what you're doing, but it's very comforting. And looking back at these books and remembering the curiosity and wonder that first inspired me to start illustration.
Yeah.
It's a book that I often go back to is Where the Wild Things Are, The Stinky Cheese Man. There's a few others. I love Little Miss Spider's Tea Party.
That's cool.
There's a bunch. And now I collect children's books too. So I love the physicality of the books, the looking at the different approaches to creating the story arcs through the pictures. I love children's books, and I have a dream
I do too.
Of doing one, and maybe one day it'll happen.
Yeah, I think it would be great for you to make a children's book, because people often underestimate children's ability to look at detailed things, I think, and we oversimplify a lot now in children's books.
Yeah, I agree.
I kind of think that that's a mistake. I really do. A lot of the 60s, like a lot of illustrators were pushing the boundaries of what it meant to talk to children. And I think now it's really not something that happens as much. It's become less of a thing, I think. I don't know. It's like the kind of stories we tell them, we think about, but we don't really think about the way we're telling them anymore.
Well, yeah, I agree with you. I think a simplified style of illustrating can reinforces a shorter attention span. And I think when it comes to this new generation of young readers, especially with screens and the amount of information being thrown at them, it's important to kind of re-engage those parts of the brain that are learning to deepen connections with the surroundings. And I think when you think slower, you can be more present in the world around you. And I think these drawings, especially these detailed, more elaborate drawings, have the ability to slow people down. They make people, they activate different parts of the brain that are deeper, I think, than a more simplified style. There is a time and place for the simplified style, and sometimes it's incredibly beautiful in its simplicity and directness of concept. But I also would love to see more layered and complex imagery being shown to younger readers.
Yeah, because when you think back of being a child, I feel like, I don't know, for me, I remember reading books that had little hidden things in them, that had little details that were the pages you could spend a long time just looking at stuff. I don't know, like I think of Richard Scarry. I used to read this.
Yeah.
And I had there was a Japanese author, I don't remember, he was popular in France, and I guess that's why my parents got it for me, but there were these little mice that lived in trees, and there were cross sections of the trees, and it was just awesome. I just love the little details in those books, and it was, yeah, I don't see a lot of that anymore, but it's, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's time that we start publishing more work like that for younger readers. I mean, some of these books I still revisit, like Where's Waldo? I have here, yeah. I have I Spy books, I have a lot of these very densely packed images, I still find new things in each of the compositions.
Yeah. Well, Armando, I think we're running out of time, but I want to thank you so much for letting me talk to you. And yeah, it was really, really interesting.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was really fun. I wish we had more time. I can't believe we're done.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, maybe we can talk again.
Yeah, that would be great. Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I hope we can chat soon.
And that was my conversation with Armando Veve. Remember, as always, you can find the show notes to this episode on our website. They will be at illustrationhour.com/Veve. That's it for this week. Thank you so much for listening.